Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM for Tuesday, January 16th. We got a good show for you today. We're going to start out by talking to the Simon Fraser Student Society. They have elections coming up and we're going to find a little bit more about that. And then we're going to bring you more on our series on traditional Chinese medicine with Chris Spangenberg and his series exploring that. All that, plus some great music, Bird Note, and a whole bunch more. Get the show started, though. I have V in the studio with me here. Hello. You are with the Simon Fraser Student Society Elections Committee, right?
That's correct, yes.
Maybe before we to start out, you can just introduce yourself.
Right. I am studying sustainable business and resource management at Simon Fraser University, and yep. I am also a big part of the IEC, which is the Independent Election Commission. We host elections for SFU and also promote them across all three campuses. We will also be there at Clubs Day, so if you want to come by and ask a few questions or just say hi, or if you want a free candy, so yeah.
Everybody likes free candy. So there are elections coming up for the Student Society, for the Simon Fraser Student Society. Tell me about what those are.
Right. So we have 7 positions available. And if you are a student at SFU and you're looking for a co-op, or maybe if you just want to make big changes around SFU, you want to be part of the change-making process, or you just want some extremely valuable experience, or maybe you want some countless networking opportunities, mm-hmm. then these 7 positions are perfect for you. We have a VP of Finance, a VP of Academic Affairs, VP of External and Community Affairs, VP of Sustainability, VP of Student Affairs, VP Internal and Organizational Development, and finally the President of SFSS, which oversees every operation.
So those positions, they represent the executive of the Student Society.
Yes, and they will also be in regular meetings with change makers around BC. I remember a lot of politicians also came last year that mm-hmm. were also involved in how much funding does SFU get, how SFSS makes changes around the campus. The Student Union building, which was built due to a process through SFSS, and a lot of big changes that are made in and around SFU, SFSS is directly involved in them.
Great. So people may not entirely realize that these are actually pretty powerful positions. The SFSS is a pretty large organization with a large budget, numbered in the millions of dollars per year. And these positions really are in charge of the whole organization.
That is true, yes. You are managing a major university body in BC, which is definitely an invaluable experience, yes.
Right. Okay. So we're at the beginning of the election process. What are sort of the steps we're going through now? Because I think nominations are now open.
Right. So first, you have to register yourself as a candidate. You can nominate yourself, and then there will be the campaign period where you can promote yourself through social media or just maybe put posters around campus, talk to people, tell them why you should be the perfect president or vice president or any position that you're applying to, and so make people vote for you or just make people vote in general, because we the more votes the better, and it just gives you the better so if you want more information, you can even go to sfss.ca/elections.
Yep.
And you can also come to my office hours, which are also found at sfss.ca/elections.
Okay. Yeah. So how long is the nomination period open? Like if someone's saying, oh, man, maybe I want to do this. How long do they have
before
they need to make a decision and act?
Right. I believe it's till January 26th, but you can confirm that at sfss.ca/elections again. Yep. And if there's any changes, it will also be posted there and on our Instagram as well, which is sfsselections.
Great. And then after the nomination period, there's the campaign period. And then when do the elections happen?
For now, I believe it's February 26th.
Okay.
But yeah, again, if there are any changes, it will be definitely posted on the sfss.ca/elections and our Instagram handle.
Great. And then these positions take office in May, I believe, at the turnover of the school year.
Yes. So once you are elected, you will be trained with a lot of team members and the previous presidents for your positions. They will make sure you're up to the right standards that you need to be. And once that's done, in the next semester, you will be in the full-fledged position.
Great. So the Simon Fraser Student Society is a nonprofit society here in BC. But because it's a big one, and unlike a lot of other nonprofits, these executive positions, actually, you get some compensation, right? Because it's a lot of work.
Yes, you do get $19.50 an hour.
Yeah.
And obviously, the experience you get is not valuable. So I would say it's a perfect opportunity. You can also claim up to 3 co-op terms as a student at SFU. And we all know how co-op can help you build up your resume and get a job later on. Yes.
Now, during the whole time, you still have to be a registered student, right?
Yes, you do have to be a full-time student at SFU. However, if you are elected, you need not take any courses.
Oh, okay.
If you want to, you can, but it is a lot of time commitment and work. So a lot of people prefer to opt for co-op and maybe take one course just so they get the flow going.
Right. So, so if they get elected, they can essentially treat it like a co-op, so they don't have to be taking any courses or a course. It's kind of like a full-time co-op experience through the period that they're...
Yes, it's a full-time experience. It's roughly 30 hours a week.
Yeah.
And, if you want to take a course, you can take a course. However, it is a lot of work and time commitment, and it's worth it.
What are some of the projects that the Student Society has been working on this year and will perhaps be issues for students next year?
Currently, we are working on the budget for the activities that goes around the events. I remember last year we did a holy event. The vice president of events, his name was Vaibhav, and he hosted a whole holy party, which is an Indian colors festival, but he made sure that everyone is included in it. And it happened around Corner Store near the upper bus loop at SFU.
Yep.
And I was there, so I know it was a pretty big success.
Yep.
And yeah, so just events like those and just promoting Clubs Day, helping other clubs get their funding for their events. This is all that SFSS does and will be doing in the future. And if there are any changes in SFU related to academics or infrastructure or anything new coming up, SFSS will be involved in the SFU meetings as well, just to discuss with them what's better as they are representing students. So,
right.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Maybe you can just, before we finish up here, what are the deadlines again, if people are interested in doing this?
Right. So the submission period is from January 15 to 28.
Yep.
That's where you can nominate yourself as a candidate. And then the campaign period is January 29 to February 25. This is where you will promote yourself and make sure you get all the votes. Then there's the election period, which is March 4 to March 18, where people will actually cast their votes online. There will be a lot of emails sent about how to do it and where to vote, and it will all be online. And then there's council general elections. That's February 19 to March 10.
Just for a finish up, just tell me a bit about council, because what we've been talking about now is the SFSS executive position. So they're essentially, for lack of a better term, they're basically jobs, leadership jobs within the student society. And then there's the council. And how does that work? Because basically the sort of governance of the SFSS is made up of the executive plus the council, which is the equivalent of sort of like a board of directors. And that's elected by each faculty or department?
Right. There are student unions involved, and it's a whole process. Again, if you want a lot of information on this, and if you're really interested in SFSS, you can go to sfss.ca/elections,
yeah.
And you will find all the information you need. There are also videos on how the SFSS operates,
yeah.
Which is, I think, a great experience. If you are a student at SFU, you will know how things work, and you'll just be aware.
Great. Yes. So, executive position elections are getting underway now, and elections for the council are happening in February, and people can go to that website to find out more information about all that.
Correct, yes.
Great. Thanks so much for coming in today, V.
Yeah, thank you for having me here. Once again, it's at sfss.ca/elections, and yeah, thank you for your time.
Thank you. So, if you want to get involved in your student union and make a difference here on the campus, now's the time to think about it and make your moves. We're going to listen to a track. This is All I from Danger Mouse.
All I
Danger Mouse and Gemini. That was All I from a brand new album from Danger Mouse. Always an artist I find interesting to check out. Love his style. Here is a Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. Birds, like mammals, are warm-blooded. It's an adaptation known as endothermy. Along with feathers and other key anatomical features, endothermy is a fundamental trait carried over from their non-avian dinosaur ancestors. Active hunters known as theropods, like the fearsome velociraptor or the T-Rex. Birds' bodies maintain a constant temperature, around 106 degrees. Their four-chambered hearts run larger than those of mammals relative to body size, and they're coupled with extremely efficient cardiovascular systems. Birds are built for a high-energy lifestyle. Their hearts pump more oxygen-rich blood per minute than those of mammals. The energy demands of flight require it. And smaller animals lose body heat more rapidly, burning the oxygen in their blood faster than larger animals. An active hummingbird's heart pumps at 1,200 beats per minute. A flying pigeon's heart beats at 600. But a human athlete, during exercise, builds up a heart rate to around only 150 beats, a mere fraction of the hummingbird's heart rate. Exercise as hard as you like. Your heart will stay in the slow lane compared to that of a bird. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Support for Bird Note is provided by Jim and Birta Falconer from Seattle, Washington, and generous listeners around the world.
Listen to music and podcasts from CGSF 90.1 FM with our radio app. It's on-the-go listening made easy. You can tune into all our music, spoken word, and multicultural shows using your device. Our app lets you set reminders so you'll never miss your favorite show again. Stay connected to CGSF 90.1 FM through our community radio app. Download the app from the Apple Store or get it on Google Play.
You're listening to CGSF 90.1 FM. This is Speak Up. Next up is we are going to bring you a presentation from our series on traditional Chinese medicine. This is a series created by Chris Spangenberg for CJSF. Oops, throwing some pens around here in the studio. Today's interview is a two-parter. It's quite an extensive interview, so we're only going to be able to bring you part one today, but we'll bring you part two next week on Tuesday. And this is Chris here is speaking to practitioner Aaron Evan. So this is Traditional Chinese Medicine with Chris Spangenberg.
Welcome to CGSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Vancouver, Burnaby Mountain. My name is Chris Spangenberg, and I am the producer of this series of interviews you are currently about to listen to. This is the fourth episode of an eight-part episodic series on traditional Chinese medicine, also known as TCM, and the traditional Chinese medicine community here in Vancouver. In the course of these interviews, I examine the local culture and practice of traditional Chinese medicine, as well as inquire into its philosophy and difference from Western medicinal practices. This series is produced for CGSF 90.1 FM's Making Time for Radio project. Today's interview is the first half of a long interview with Dr. Avon Evan, an acupuncturist, herbalist, translator, and clinic owner of Rocky Mountain Wellness in Port Moody. Avon stands out in the TCM community for his interest and scholarship in classical Chinese medicine, especially classic Chinese medicine texts such as the Yellow Emperor's Classic of Chinese Medicine and the Treatise on Cold Damage Disorders. He is also involved with translation of such texts into English. In the first part of the interview with Avon, we significantly discuss his background and practice of Chinese medicine. We start off with how he was introduced to Chinese medicine and how he began his path towards an enthusiastic study of classical Chinese medicine. Next, we talk about his experiences studying Chinese medicine in both Canada and China and his studies under Dr. Yulan Bai and Professor Huang. Following that, we discuss Avon's approach to healing and practice. We end the first part of the interview discussing the main differences between Chinese medicine and Western medicine and how they could best work together. My name is Chris Spangenberg, and you are listening to an interview between me and Dr. Avon Evan here on CGSF 90.1 FM.
So Ivan, tell me a little bit about yourself and your history.
Sure. My name is Iran Evan. I was born in Tel Aviv, Israel. My family moved to Toronto, actually, when I was 5 years old, where I grew up, and I moved out to British Columbia in 1999 to work and apprentice under a herbalist in Victoria. It was then pretty much when I decided to study traditional Chinese medicine.
For how long have you been practicing traditional Chinese medicine?
I've graduated initially from the undergraduate Chinese medicine program in 2003, so I've been in practice on and off since then, with stints in China, back and forth. But I've been in consistent practice now since 2006, so for 10 years now, consistently.
How did you end up working with traditional Chinese medicine? What first got you interested in the field?
What brought me into Chinese medicine was actually herbal medicine. I had studied herbal medicine in 1997 in Toronto. That was my first degree, what I did, and it was all Western herbal medicine, and which brought me out to British Columbia because I had an opportunity to work and apprentice with a very well-known herbalist at a very renowned herbal shop in Victoria that had been there at that point for close to 30 years already. And I was very disillusioned, to be quite honest, because, you know, with Western herbal medicine, it wasn't really any different than allopathic medicine in the sense that one plant was meant to treat one problem. And I got very disillusioned very quickly because I found that it only worked some of the time. It was a very hit or miss situation. It was like, here's a plant, you have a headache, take this plant, it's good for headaches, but it wasn't really the case. And so one of my coworkers actually gave me a book about Chinese medicine. It was a book called The Web That Has No Weaver, which is actually a very, very famous book in Chinese medicine now, to read. And I was very intrigued by the concept of differential diagnosis, where treatments are applied based on differential diagnosis, where, you know, you can have one plant or one formula, one herb to treat many conditions, or, you know, one condition can be treated with a multitude of different herbs and stuff. And I was very intrigued, and so I did a lot more research, looked into Chinese medicine, and as I typically do in my life, I just jumped in the fire and enrolled in a program and started studying and haven't looked back since.
So what benefits do you see in Chinese medicine?
There's a lot of benefits. I mean, that's a big question. I think one of the beauties of Chinese medicine is its ability to treat chronic, long-standing conditions. You know, I think that, you know, in a parallel between Western biomedical medicine and Chinese medicine, you know, Western medicine excels at treating acute conditions, at treating emergency conditions, and where I think we really shine is treating very long-standing, very chronic conditions in patients that have been offered no help, or, you know, in hopes to get them to reduce their current Western medications. And I think that that's truly where we shine. I think that Chinese medicine views the body in a very, very holistic sense, in a very holistic way, that really gives us a very clear understanding of how a person's physiology is off. And so, you know, we're typically not looking for a pathology per se, we're looking more for physiology and how to regulate that in the body. So the benefits of Chinese medicine are quite vast, actually.
What differentiates you from other practitioners and doctors of traditional Chinese medicine is your skill in Mandarin and your extensive scholarship and ancient traditional Chinese medicine texts. Where would you say your excitement for Mandarin and the scholarship of traditional Chinese medicine comes from?
Initially, when I graduated school in 2003, I started to study Chinese because my objective was to move to China, and work in the hospitals, but I didn't want to rely on translators. I wanted to hear it from the patients themselves. I knew the Chinese medicine worked, and it wasn't an issue about that, but I really needed to know that it worked, and I needed to go to China, I needed to work with the patients, and I wanted to be able to communicate with them in their own language. And so that began my study of conversational Chinese. Well, I wasn't really studying classical Chinese. I wasn't really studying it to learn how to read or anything. That wasn't really my objective. My objective was just to have conversations and to hear, you know, talk to patients and stuff. And so I had started to do an apprenticeship with a couple local Chinese doctors after I graduated in 2003 here in Burnaby. And they're very well versed in classics and had started to urge me to really kind of explore that avenue and maybe begin to read. And I took it a little bit seriously. I was like, okay, sure, whatever. It's so hard. There's so many characters. So I went to China in 2005, And, you know, my Chinese was okay. It wasn't bad. I thought it was a lot better when I was here. And then I got there into Beijing and with the dialect, I was like, oh my God, my Chinese is horrible. And when it was there, when I was in China, I had enrolled in the Chinese program, in the graduate program in Chinese, lived in a Chinese apartment building, didn't really mingle with the expat community, so I really, really jumped in the fire in that regard. And I had a lot of time on my hands, and that time was literally spent going through dictionaries and learning characters, learning how to read. I had a couple friends who were also teaching me. I had a couple of private tutors that we were doing exchanges with. And I really, really worked very hard at learning how to read. And that was back in the days where it was all paper dictionaries. Now you've got these amazing apps on your phones and you've got character recognition. It's become a different world in that sense. This was, you know, painstakingly looking for characters, looking up radicals and really learning how to read the characters. And so I'd really gotten deep into the reading over there. And then one of my mentors over there had really urged me to delve deep into the classics. And in order to really read the classics, because there's very little translated into English, I had to read it in the source language. I had to learn classical Chinese. I had to really learn how to delve deep into those books. And that really, really opened up my eyes to a whole nother world, which I was never really exposed to prior to my time with my teachers in Beijing. And that really opened up my eyes. And it really changed my life in a sense of showing me how important the classics were and really, really having to beef up my Chinese in order to access them.
Where did you do your study of traditional Chinese medicine?
I began my studies at a local Burnaby college called the Shanghai College of Traditional Chinese Medicine. Unfortunately, like many other colleges in the Lower Mainland, it shut down a few years ago as well, which I guess is a whole other topic of discussion. But in my opinion, is probably a good thing because I think that we need Chinese medicine to move into the public system, which it's doing as of this fall, moving into Kwantlen University. But so I started my studies there. I did an apprenticeship for close to 2 years with two local doctors, helping them see patients and just observing in clinic, learning Chinese as well because it was mainly a Chinese-only speaking clinic in Burnaby here. And then I did graduate training at the Beijing University of Chinese Medicine where we did classes, but I mainly did my residency over there working at the Chinese-Japanese Friendship Hospital. I had to think of the English name, sorry. And where I also worked with another one of my mentors, Dr. Fan Jianglun, who is a classical medicine and yangsheng, you know, nourishing the body practitioner, very, very famous in Beijing. And then after that, I did a program, a two-year program through the Institute of Classics in East Asian Medicine based out of Portland, Oregon, where we literally studied the Shanghan Lun and the Jingguayale, which are very, very old Han Dynasty classic texts, very important, considered the herbal Bibles, really, of this field. And so that was a two-year program, and I'm currently 2 years into a PhD, a doctoral program at the Nanjing University of Chinese Medicine, doing it under a very, very well-known doctor, Dr. Huang Huang.
Could you briefly describe your experience studying Chinese medicine? How is the curriculum and what were the expectations studying at a higher level in China?
To be quite honest, the curriculum is very similar to how it is in North America. There isn't really a huge difference. I think that a lot of the programs here in North America base their curriculum on the programs in the People's Republic, and so there are a lot of similarities. However, the big and this I really think is the defining difference between the two is the sheer number of patients that you are exposed to in China. You know, when you're working in a residency program there, depending on if you're in an acupuncture ward or if you're in a herbal medicine ward, you could be seeing anywhere between 70 to 120 patients a day on average, five, usually 6 days a week. And I mean, those numbers, that would take you a good year in North America or at most of the North American school student clinics to see. So to me, that's really the biggest difference. And there's always a high expectation. I think that in the Chinese school system, there's always a high expectation on their students. But I honestly don't think as a foreigner, the expectation is as high on me as it might be as a local student, but that doesn't mean that we don't work hard still. And so I think that we really try to earn the respect of our teachers by working as hard as our peers as well.
Could you briefly talk about your experiences studying under Dr. Yulan Bai in China and also with Professor Huang at the Nanjing University of Chinese Medicine?
Absolutely. Dr. Bai was my acupuncture teacher in Beijing. She's a very feisty older woman. And to be quite honest with you, my